Good evening, and welcome to episode, what?
150,000
of They Came From the North. I am your host for the evening, Andrew Forbes. With me are, in Montreal, Gabriel Girard.
Bonjour.
And in St. John's, the, well, I don't want to say tag team, but...
Welcome, neither of us in St. John's.
Neither of us is in St. John's.
What?
we're in communities and suburbs very close to St. John's.
Hey, I'm in another city, damn it.
That's a fake city, and you goddamn know.
How dare you, sir?
There's one city in Newfoundland, Steve. I hate to break it to you.
There are three, almost four.
by no one else's definition. Yeah. In the small fishing community of slightly outside St. John's, Steve Power.
Bonjour.
And in the bustling metropolis of, I don't know, you're not in Dildo, are you?
I might as well be, though. I'm afraid if I say the name, I live in Seal Cove.
Seal Cove. Get your hammer ready. John Mercer.
It's that remote that when I drive through it, I say, drive faster, I hear banjos.
I'm terrified in the wintertime I'm going to get attacked by Yeti in the walk from my house to my van.
Yeah, that's what passes for urban crime in Newfoundland.
Fourth highest crime rate in Canada, yo, represent. Those Yetis are out of hand.
All right. Anyway, those are our introductions. Tonight... we are talking about someone who, as far as I'm concerned, and I may be the only one, doesn't get quite enough credit when people are talking about sort of masters of the mid-century Western. They talk a lot about John Ford. They talk a lot about Howard Hawks. And I often feel that one name is missing from the discussion. He is someone who had a fairly significant influence on the maturation of the genre, bringing a whole lot of psychological tension, brutality, and a more complex adult sensibility to the genre that previously often fell into fairly simplistic moral formula. Before Sergio Leone pushed the limits of visual style and violence, before Sam Peckinpah threw a whole bunch of gore and sex across the screen, Anthony Mann was taking bleak plots, fuzzy morality, and hard-boiled violence of film noir and placing it in a Western context. That's not to say that he was only a director of Westerns. He produced films in a broad range of genres, from cheap thrillers to historical epics to war films to family dramas. But I'm getting ahead of myself. So Anthony Mann was born Emil Anton Bundesmann in 1906 in San Diego, California. His showbiz career did not start behind the camera. It was on stage. He was an actor, a production manager, a set designer, and eventually a director in New York off-Broadway. In 1938, he went to California. He got a job with David O. Selznick, acting primarily as a scout director. But during this time, he was able to direct several screen tests for Selznick Productions, notably Rebecca and Gone with the Wind. In 1939, he got some work at Paramount. He worked as an assistant director. He was ultimately promoted to directing work on low-budget thrillers, worked at studios like RKO and Republic during the early to mid-40s. In the latter half of the decade, though, Mann came into his own as a director. He crafted some very notable film noir, such as Raw Deal, Side Street, Border Incident, and T-Men. In 1950, he directed his first of a series of Westerns with James Stewart. Over the next half decade, he would direct Stewart six more times. In 1957, he walked off the set of Night Passage after a falling out with Stewart, and that ended their previously very fruitful collaboration. Westerns tended to dominate this period of Mann's career, although he also directed in other genres, including war films, like Men in War, dramas like Serenade. He even did a biopic with the Glenn Miller story. In the early 1960s, Mann directed a couple of massive historical epics for super producer Samuel Bronston El Cid in 1961 and the fall of the Roman Empire in 1964. The latter was budgeted at about $20 million, which in 1964 dollars was a crazy, crazy budget. The sets broke all kinds of records for scale. There were huge set pieces. Appropriately to the subject of the film, it was an enormous flop. Stephen Boyd, who played the lead, blamed the failure of the movie for ruining his career, although I might argue on the causality in that scenario. It may have been that Stephen Boyd contributed somewhat to lack of interest. After Empire, Mann directed the little-remembered Heroes of Telemark, and then his last film was A Dandy in Aspic, which he didn't finish. He died of a heart attack at the age of only 60, and the film was completed by star Lawrence Harvey. Now, starting with his late 40s thrillers, Mann quickly developed what I think is a quite recognizable style. He employed quite dramatic blocking of actors at extreme areas of the frame. He experimented quite a bit with placement, sort of figuring out ways of placing actors that created tension and made for interesting sort of playing off of different performances. He used a lot of deep focus framing, close-up depictions of violence, and indeed violence is probably one of the most notable elements of Mann's films. It is not trivial in his films. Unlike the westerns of John Ford or Howard Hawks, which although they have moments of very serious violence, it's often played for laughs or downplayed somewhat. Mann's films really stress the struggle and the suffering inherent in violent action. His villains are often physically or psychologically sadistic, inflicting extreme pain on the heroes or even just on bystanders. If you consider James Stewart being shot in the hand in The Man from Laramie, the way that is shot is extraordinarily brutal for the time. Or Raymond Burr throwing a plate full of boiling crepes into the face of an innocent partygoer in Raw Deal. That was 2 full years before Lee Marvin gave Gloria Graham an unwanted pot of coffee to the dome in the big heat. Another major element of Mann's films is power. At the heart of most of his films, or his most interesting films' conflicts, there's a struggle for control of life, land, money. You have greedy ranchers and struggling cowboys, which is fairly common. Opportunistic merchants and vulnerable settlers. Parents and children come up quite a bit. The power dynamics between men and women, the poor and the rich. The tension between the powerful and the powerless drives the plots of most of his best movies. They can be sometimes melodramatic, sometimes simmering with a very sort of low-key suspense, but they are always entertaining, always engaging. So without any more of this blabbery, let's dig into the good, the bad, and the brutally ugly of what I like to think of as a virtuoso of violence and psychological pain, Anthony Mann. So I am going to start with Steve Power. Oh, what is your good?
You jerk.
I can switch up. I can go somewhere else, but I know John's finishing his notes.
Did you say something? What? I'm ready to go. My homework's done.
For Anthony Mann, I haven't seen everything, of course, because it's just there's so much, and there are some films there that are really, really hard to find. But he is a director who a number of years ago, probably about a decade or so ago, I took an interest in, and kind of went back and started looking for whatever I could find. Of course, saw the Jimmy Stewart westerns, his big historical epics, which I was hugely excited to see released on DVD a few years ago.
And which we need on Blu-ray.
Oh, man, would be phenomenal on Blu-ray. The big thing with me is, of course, I am a big Western fan, and I am a huge fan of historical epics. Like, I consider myself a study of historical epics, you know? Like, I sit down and I devour them over and over again kind of thing. The thing with Mann, with his historical epics in particular, El Cid and The Fall of the Roman Empire, I found that they were some of the very few at the time. I mean, you know, Hollywood, and even a decade after his films, you know, like, Hollywood was really big on these biblical epics, you know, stuff like Ben-Hur and before
King
him. Kings. Yeah, you know, the Ten Commandments, The Robe. And I mean, all of these productions had these, like, lavish sets, beautiful costumes, you know, but they had this sense of air of theatricality about them. They had this air of, like, being like a stage production, you know, they had this, that stage acting, the costumes were designed to look like costumes, you know, like nothing really had that, like a lot of it looked beautiful and was well filmed, but just didn't feel real. Whereas El Cid and the Fall of the Roman Empire had more of a naturalistic look, like they looked authentic. I mean, and the only other film out of the era that I could really, you know, level that on would probably be Ben-Hur. And between El Cid and the Fall of the Roman Empire, I guess I have to go towards El Cid because Charlton Heston is freaking awesome in that movie.
He is really good.
He is. He's really good.
He doesn't irritate me as much in that.
Yeah. And you know, he is out of his element. He's almost as out of his element here as he is in, what was the Wells film noir?
Touch of Evil.
Yeah, Touch of Evil, you know. Charlton Heston playing a Mexican.
He's playing a Spaniard here.
Yeah, I know.
I'm one of the few people who actually thinks he does okay.
I love Touch of Evil. I mean, I love Touch of Evil.
I don't get quite the degree of criticism you get for that.
Yeah, no, I do. I absolutely adore that movie. You know, that's my Citizen Kane is probably Touch of Evil. But anyway, as much as I love, you know, Winchester 73 is a fantastic little movie. The Man from Laramie was really good. But I gotta go with El Cid. Just, I found Fall of the Roman Empire is a little on the long side. I found you get a lot more of, it almost felt like, you know, what, 15 or 18 big-name international actors all kind of fighting for attention. Whereas Cid felt like a more tightly focused, more polished, and just beautifully told story. And, I mean, you get those amazing sequences like that run at the end of it. I won't spoil anything, but you know, the final charge at the end of the movie, towards the end of the movie, final act, you know, it's a beautifully shot film, and it doesn't have that theatricality to it that you see in stuff like the 300 Spartans, and it's a really cracking movie, and like costumes and stuff, set design, beautiful, beautiful stuff. Really well done. And just from a visual standpoint alone, the look of the movie, I'm a big sucker for contrast when you get a lot of high contrast, really deep pools of black and stuff like that. And El Cid is beautifully lit, you know? It's got a wonderfully stark look to it, you know, between like these earth tones and browns and then just these really dark, murky pools of black. And it's a great look.
I'd have a real hard time coming up with better movies, at least better shot movies in that same period.
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
With the exception of, obviously, you know, David Lean.
Well, yeah.
And I'm sure I'll get no argument from you.
No, absolutely not. But, yeah, and I mean, like, you can't even compare them, really, because Lean is just, I mean, Lean really is the, you know, one of the fathers of cinema, I guess, in that regard. But, you know, a man really did some great work, like, especially in that, like, that later period of his. I liked pretty much everything I've seen from that there. I even liked the double agent movie. What is the Dandy and Aspic?
I was very pleasantly surprised by that.
Yeah, I mean, I even enjoyed that. I thought it was a pretty good movie. And I mean, by all accounts, I remember, was it Ebert or Leonard Maltin or someone basically called the movie an unmitigated disaster. I enjoyed it. I thought it was really good. I mean, yeah, it was a little confusing at times. It was a little muddy, you know, but I did really enjoy it. But yeah, no,
it was a weird time for film criticism.
Yeah. It was a transition.
It was no worse than Osterman Weekend.
That wasn't an offhanded compliment. I don't know what was.
I love the Osterman Weekend in the worst way.
Yeah, so do I, but it doesn't make any goddamn sense.
No, it really doesn't. But yeah, I guess...
Okay, in the movie.
El Cid for sure. Great performances. I'm not a big Sophia Loren fan. And for some reason, like, normally she can kind of coast on her beauty, but in this she kind of looks a little bit like an alien. That said, you know, I enjoyed the movie. I thought it was nice, tight performances, well scripted.
It's her eyebrows, man. Her eyebrows in El Cid are freaky looking. No, it looks like they've been carved, like, out of wood. There's no movement,
lifeless.
Yeah, she looks like a Dragon Age character.
Oh my. Anyway, yeah, no, El Cid, definitely my good. I almost wanted to say Fall of the Roman Empire, but I have to go.
Can I jump in after Steve? Because El Cid was also my good.
All right, Gabe, go ahead.
God damn you four. I'll freely admit that it's typical melodrama with very few surprises. But the sort of people who complain about that thing usually fail to grasp exactly why they're complaining about it.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, as a big historical epic, it just works. You know, I'm a sucker for bellowing dialogue and thundering scores, and it's a pure lavish screen spectacle.
Man, the scale of the movie is just unreal.
And in the hands of Mann, especially late career Anthony Mann, this was what, 61?
Yeah.
So towards the end of his career, it turns out Six Shades more brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
Heston is great. You know, if you're going to call Heston's acting wooden, in El Cid, he's like a big imposing oak tree.
Set on fire.
could he look any more badass than with that scar on his face?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the sets are amazing. The big battle scene in is on a scale that is just jaw-dropping. And not even, I don't want to be cliche-ancy, especially when you consider it was in 1961. No, this is jaw-dropping. It'd be jaw-dropping today.
Yeah.
And that's the thing, between that and the Fall of the Roman Empire, like, yes, they did have thousands of extras, and they did have these huge sets that, like, I think Fall of the Roman Empire, the Roman Forum is the largest set ever constructed. But, you know, like, they felt... Like, it didn't even feel big for the time. It's like, you know, it's like the Aqaba scene from Lawrence of Arabia, you know, like, you can't believe you're watching this on a film that was made in the early 1960s.
I mean, there's one scene in particular from Fall of the Roman Empire that I think of where you just have these just troops just swarming as far as you can see.
And man, and those costumes,
this rolling landscape.
The costumes, like the shields and the helmets and stuff, like, it looked awesome. Like, it wasn't... This was Gladiator good in terms of production design, you know? It wasn't cheesy and theatrical looking, you know? It was authentic looking.
I was looking for a shot of Heston earlier, I just want to see how awesome the scar was again. And it was just a shot of him leaning over the horse with the chainmail coif and everything on.
Yep.
And it's just, it's fucking great costume.
Oh, it is, man.
But I've got a soft spot for these over-the-top, ridiculous epics, you know, Ben-Hur, Sodom and Gomorrah, and El Cid is one of the best ones. It really, it's fantastic. And, go Google Martin Scorsese.
He loves this movie.
Well, didn't he spearhead the restoration on DVD?
Yeah, I believe he did, yeah.
Yeah, when he finishes his next six Leonardo DiCaprio movies, he can get working on the Blu-ray.
I think he sat Harvey Weinstein down in a chair, lit a fire under him, and said, "You're going to start a new label for movies called the Miriam Collection. And these are the two movies you're going to put out first." All right. Gabe, what's your good?
I'm a bit the opposite of Steve, where while I enjoy Westerns, I'm not a fan of Westerns per se, and historical epics are really not my thing. But noir is. And Anthony made one of the most badass noirs of all time, and that movie is Raw Deal.
Yes. The Schwarzenegger epic.
No, Magic not the Schwarzenegger.
Or Magnet.
My dad rented that 4 times in a row. Four weekends in a row. John, there's a new Schwarzenegger movie. And, oh, God damn it.
We are not talking about the Schwarzenegger movie.
That was a remake, wasn't it? No, I'm only kidding.
I don't think it's
tied
in any way.
You said that so that you could correct our pronunciation, didn't you? You just wanted to say something in German.
Yes.
Arnold Schwarzenegger.
We're talking about a movie made in 1948, very low budget, This is a traditional noir setup where a guy once gets out of prison, and the guy he's taking the rap for wants to kill him to get rid of like evidence or whatever. I don't think we really know why he wants to kill him.
He seems like it's kind of just like there's a sense of paranoia over the whole
thing. Yeah, I mean, it's like the purpose of the thing is not very, very clear, but I mean, that adds to the incredible atmosphere that man creates in this film. Of course, the main hero of the movie is actually John Alton, director of photography, who, wow.
There's some amazing shadows in this movie.
Words cannot express how amazing a job he did in this movie. Just the use of this, I'm going to completely mangle, but chiaroscuro. And
chiaroscuro.
It's one of those noirs where it really feels gritty and disturbing, but at the same time, it's really wonderful to look at, and the photography is amazing. You know, it doesn't feel like a Laurent cheapy, you know, that was filmed in like 20 seconds, you know, and that was just trying to be violent for the sake of being Pulp Fiction, you know. There's something vital about it, like, there's an electricity in the movie, I find. And, I mean...
And Raymond Burr is, like, insane.
He plays...
Like, if you only know him from Perry Mason, dig back and see the kind of guys he used to play.
And like, Dennis O'Keefe is the perfect, like, convict, you know, too.
Mm-hmm.
Just his face is, like... You know, this guy he looks like a guy who's done some time, you know?
The name's escaping me, but who plays the lead female character?
Claire Trevor,
yeah. She's really good.
She's really good. And she actually makes her voiceover work despite the annoying use of theremin. Yeah, I mean that's the only thing I didn't really like about the movie was like, although the narration is nice and like it's written well, just the fact that it sounds so wistful and like dreamy and with the theremin was like it takes you away a bit from the atmosphere the movie is trying to create. But yeah, I mean this is really like the equivalent of a good art boil like. Novel that you could find.
A really old, beaten up paperback.
Yeah. With an awesome cover.
That you find out was written by, I don't know, Donald Westlake under a pseudonym.
Yeah, exactly. Or George Stark.
But someone with a worse grasp of making sense.
Oh yeah, the movie doesn't really make sense. I mean, you never really understand what's going on, but it's not. I don't think
it kind of doesn't matter. Fact that you know sort of who's after who, and like that's kind of as much setup as you need.
And going from the movies I've seen from Antem Niman, I think that's something that he tried to bring to his westerns too. And I think I'll get more of my thoughts later, but. A lot of his movies I've seen kind of start and the action's already started.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're kind of dropped in the middle of the story.
Yeah.
And you're kind of discovering what's going on as the movie comes along. And like the characters are already kind of there when you arrive and they're of a piece. Like for example, The Furies, which I think, Andrew, you'll get to. it starts with a guy riding to the ranch, and then he gets there and he sees the girl he sees Barbara Stanwyck in the room, and the first thing is something like, "Oh, I knew you would be here," and you have like no idea who these people are,
who they are, what they're doing, what they're talking about. Yeah,
but yeah, Rod Eel, It's really, really, really good.
I concur. Also, burning liquid to the face for no real reason other than Raymond Burr is just horrible. yeah, on that note, I will talk about my good, which is The Furies. I love this movie. I'm not even necessarily going to say it's his best movie, but I think it's most sort of representative of what he does really well. Martin Scorsese, when he talks about Anthony Mann, he has a way of talking about filmmakers from this period, and one of the things he calls them is smugglers. And what he means by that is bringing in sort of suggestions of maybe themes and ideas in terms of violence and sex that the Hays Code would not allow. And there is so much going on in The Furies. It doesn't necessarily totally hold together, but it is so watchable.
Are you talking about something like rub my lower rib?
Oh, yeah, my lumbar vertebrae.
Yeah,
whatever. So just as a quick setup, I mean, The Furies is basically about a father and a daughter. The father is a powerful ranch owner, and the daughter is the sort of more forceful, willful child. His son, her brother, is kind of, he's not really big business material. And it's essentially sort of a big Western melodrama. It's this weird combination of like Anthony Sirk, is it Anthony? No, Douglas Sirk, like women's movie, as they were called, and like really tough, brutal Western. So there's so much going on here. You have the sort of sexual dynamics. You've got these weird sort of Oedipal relationships between Barbara Stanwyck and her father and sort of her mother. There are shades of Rebecca in the way that she sort of regards her mother as being sort of this ideal person, and her, you know, her room and her clothes should never be touched. There are all kinds. She's got two sort of side relationships, one with a not entirely trustworthy guy called Rip Darrow, played by Wendell Corey, and another with a Mexican, Juan Herrera, who is part of a group of settlers who are now considered squatters, who Stanwyck's father is trying to run off the ranch. Who's that ringing? Unacceptable.
Wasn't me.
T.C. Jeffords is the big ranch owner, played by Walter Houston. And this was his last performance, I think.
At the end?
Well, I don't think they actually shot Houston. But
I think they did. It looked real enough.
It is an amazing performance. I mean, it is like bigger than life, but in the way where you really believe this is a guy who just behaves that way. It's huge and melodramatic, but somehow not cartoonish. Still, like whenever he's angry, you get a sense that he's got the real capacity for being a real bastard. To add on to this sort of swirl of relationships, there's a character played by Judith Anderson who comes in midway through the movie, who is T.C. Jeffords' new wife. Barbara Stanwyck's character does not take well to her, sees her as sort of replacing her mother. You want to talk about moments of sadistic violence?
Yeah.
There's a great one between Barbara Stanwyck and Judith Anderson in this movie.
I don't know if I'd call
visually,
it great.
let's say a typically Anthony Mann moment of sadistic violence. This is, I think, one of his most sort of typically, if you want to look at Anthony Mann's personal style, this is a great place to look. I personally think that he has a quite distinctive style. And he experiments a lot in this movie with placement of people in landscape, placement of people in relation to others within one frame, sort of stacking people at one side of the screen and sort of stepping them down as they recede into the background. There's almost too much to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
But it's, if you want to watch a movie that is just a swirl of sort of psychological power plays and a whole lot of sort of hidden implications and, shall we say, mature content under the surface, The Furies is really, really good, and it is really entertaining, especially because of Walter Huston.
Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I felt there was a little irony too in the movie, like especially with the ending that like the last song playing over the credits is the songs the Rain Ranchers made about TC. But this isn't really a movie about TC, you know.
It's about Stanwyck. But it, I mean, at the same time, it is about TC because it's about these power structures, I guess, to get a little pretentious sounding. That get set up and how they sort of, they're sort of the eye of a storm and all of these people sort of swirl around and you get all of this destruction. So he's sort of the figurative center of it.
Yeah.
He's not the character that, he's certainly not the character you identify with most.
And at the same time, that part of it as a thing that resonates with a lot of Westerns where you see the creation of the legend, but at the same time you see was actually behind the legend, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like, you get to see him at home, but those people ride with him don't really know that, man. They just know TC who fights with the ball, you know?
Yeah. And one more thing I wanted to say, and this sort of touches on Anthony Mann in general. There are some directors, I think there are sort of two kinds of directors that are very interesting to sort of engage with their films. They're the ones who have a very clear idea of the structure and the arc and a fully rounded theme of the movie. John Ford, for example, with The Searchers, right? He knew every bit of structure going into it, how everything was going to play together. And then there are guys like Mann, who you could argue it's not quite as much of an achievement, but I think it's still sort of really interesting. He likes to sort of use the movie as a playground, to throw a whole bunch of things in and see how they play off of each other. So one is kind of this very carefully crafted product, and Mann is more like a sandbox.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not always successful, but he's always taking these very sort of recognizable scenarios and genres, and he's twisting them just a little bit, you know, blurring lines a little bit in terms of who's moral and who's not. Injecting a little bit of extra violence and not always sort of directed at people or directed from people who you would expect. And throwing in little implications of stuff that you didn't always see in movies from this period.
before we move on, I want to just throw in there that like one of the movies I saw where I thought that kind of approach worked the best because there was kind of a through line was Winchester 73.
Oh, absolutely.
Or it is.
Which I could have easily chosen as my
guess. Yeah, which is that old melting pot, but at the same time they had this brilliant idea of putting the rifle in as the connecting link to all these different stories. And for that reason, I thought, for me, that movie and Raw Deal are the ones that engaged me the most of Anthony Mann's movies. I kind of had a hard time getting into his movies. Even The Furies, which, you know, I really love, but I found it kind of a drag and a bit to kind of get into, you know.
I find one thing Mann kind of, I'm assuming it happens when he develops too, like you find his stuff gets kind of convoluted. You know, so-and-so did this, and then this happens, and then this happens.
All the movies I have enjoyed better the second time I've watched them.
And I could very easily see that.
Order Incident, the first time I watched it, I hated it. The second time I watched it, it became one of my favorite film noirs.
Yeah, and I mean, I think one of the things to compare him with John Ford is that Ford seems to be much more like down to earth with his characters. You know, he's in there and he's feeling them like fully alive. While man, I have a feeling they're more like archetypes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're more kind of stiff, and he really like he keeps you more a bit of the distance, and that's where you see the modern. You know, I think that's the problem with man.
He is a little bit more sort of. He's got that sort of laboratory distance a bit.
Yeah, and
Kubrickian.
Yeah,
which is funny because he originally was the director of Spartacus.
Yeah, and I
think a bit my problem with man. Well, it's not a big problem, but I mean the thing with man is because he is a transitional guy, you know,
mm-hmm.
because he was trying all these things, but he didn't really like, you know, have enough. Either chutzpah or the studio was on him or in a vision to carry all everything.
He was sort of enough under the thumb of the studio, without maybe as much. If he had been super, super, super sly, he probably could have, made more fully formed films.
Yeah.
But he was enough under the thumb of the studio that he had to sort of, I don't want to say slapdash, because that's really unfair to him, because that suggests that he wasn't an extremely intelligent filmmaker, and he was. But he did. He definitely had to play with things and find out how they worked, and then build from the last movie to figure out with the next movie, okay, let's see if I can push it a little bit further or turn it in a little bit of a different direction. So you didn't get a lot of movies that felt entirely fully like, oh, this is a totally formed subversive film that was somehow made under the studio system.
Like I didn't choose it for my bad, but for example, you know, like The Naked Spur, which I found really interesting, but I had a hard time getting into, but and I'm like I'm trying to analyze, you know, trying to understand. Because I'm like,
there's,
you know,
there's a lot going on, but it's kind of like we're making this up as we go.
Yeah, and I mean, Jimmy Stewart is super badass in this movie. I've never seen Jimmy Stewart like this before.
Oh, I know. And like him playing against Robert Ryan. Anyway, yeah, we're going on a tangent here. So those are our good. Let's now talk about our bad. I will start again with Steve, if you're ready.
Yeah, I think so. I think. I don't really have a whole lot to say about it because you covered the ground pretty well, but my bad, I actually am going to go with the Furies.
Okay.
Main reason being, what you said about it is accurate. You know, I gotta say, I give full props to what you said, but it's because of something that you said that I consider it a bad, and that's the melodrama.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
It does lay it on a little too thick for my tastes.
And ordinarily, I think I wouldn't like it, but I... Walter Houston connects to some part of my brain.
I understand it, and I'm indifferent to Walter Houston. I'm just kind of like, yeah, okay. But the whole thing, like the subplot about just, you know, I guess he's supposed to be the linchpin of the movie and stuff, you know, but TC is just such an unlikable character for me. You know, like,
he's
just so pretentious, yeah. And he's so like the TC notes and all of this stuff, and you know, I'm just like
self-made man.
Yeah, you know, like I find they play it way too heavy, and I just by the end I have no sympathy for the guy. And then of course the whole, and I think at the time I'm sure it was shocking and brilliant, but they pull a, for lack of a better word, I don't even know what to call it. That shocker. You know, the whole...
An emotional Shyamalan?
Yeah, no, yeah, there we go. You know, that whole, yeah, maybe I could start from scratch. Bang! You know? that whole, you know, big grand awakening, emotional awakening, and okay, oh yeah, and I'm reformed, and everything is good. Bang! Sorry, your past sins are not going to let you escape. I mean, you know?
And that totally comes out of, like, Anthony Mann's film noir.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it is a noir thing, but noir protagonists are kind of usually, you know, you get that impression that, I mean, it's one of the rules of film noir, like these people have done horrible things that they can never get away with, you know, like the character, the main character, the protagonist, or, you know, the least reprehensible of a bunch of reprehensible people has to get his comeuppance, and it's at the same time, you know, it's kind of a,
you try to apply it just this sort of weird, like, P.T. Barnum.
Yeah, yeah, you know, like, and it's kind of a situation where, like, it can't really end any other way because you've done some terrible things and you got to pay for it. But this this guy was kind of like, I equate it to A History of Violence, which is a movie I absolutely despise because of its ending. And, you know, like, with me, it kind of, it takes whatever message, whatever positive, uplifting message or whatever, you know, good thing you could take from the movie, and it just totally flushes it for shock value. You know, and and that is what kills the Furies for me. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I know we're in...
Are you talking History of Violence or American History X?
Or American History X, sorry. American History X, my bad, sorry.
Yeah, oh yeah.
That's what I meant.
So don't make me come over and crone and slap you.
I was like, don't you love A History of Violence?
Yes, I do.
I'm
on the third big Russian of the evening, okay? I'm sorry.
Oh, you're talking to a guy who has no alcohol in his house.
But yeah, no, it's
straight Frangelico.
But yeah, that's my big thing with it. You know, it falls into that whole, it almost feels like it was done for shock value rather than to serve the story, to serve the character. You know, like in a film noir, you know, you're watching something like Double Indemnity and, or, you know, Raw Deal or The Big Sleep or any of the, like all of the classic noir movies, it, like, you know, you get the comeuppance and it's satisfying. Yeah. But with this one, it's like, oh, okay, I'm just starting to like this guy, and we kill him.
Hey,
it turns into the Great Silence, and John starts to cry. And
now, see, I love the Great Silence.
Deletes the file from his computer and buries his laptop.
Don't start spoiling the Great Silence, because that's one I really want to see and haven't gotten around to.
Oh, I'm sorry. But yeah, you know, that's what turns me from the movie. I mean, it is a good movie. It's an entertaining flick. But I think...
But it doesn't entirely cohere.
No, it definitely does not. And, like, there are times it feels like this dark, earnest, you know, like, there are times it feels genuine and it feels real, and then there are other times that it feels like the worst kind of, you know, 1950s Hollywood melodrama. And that's, you know, like, it goes too much between...
I kind of see that as sort of, that's kind of the template they were working on to sell it.
Yeah,
You know? Well, you know, I'm going to do my big melodrama now, but I'm going to throw all in all this kind of weird stuff.
It kind of leers back. It's like a drunk driver on a road in the middle of the night. And on one side of the road is Gone with the Wind, and on the other side of the road is the Wild Bunch. And it just kind of keeps veering back and forth between the two.
And it gets right to the entrance to the driveway.
And then it hits a...
I was just going to say that you can definitely feel the Selznick, you know, apprenticeship in the Furies.
Yeah. I mean, and like I said, it's not even that it's a horrible movie, because, I mean, that's our rule anyway. You know, it's not that it's a terrible film, but it's my bad for that reason.
It would make a great double feature with Rebecca.
Yeah, there you go.
It is one of those, this one feels like a Selznick production. I can't remember who actually produced it. Rebecca was, and it's sort of filmmakers working with kind of creepy material, but also fairly melodramatic material.
Yeah.
In a studio system. So, anyway. Bad. Boom. John.
My bad. Oh, I decided to go with The Bamboo Blonde from 1946.
Oh. One I have not seen.
Nor me.
It's really kind of middle of the road from Man. It's a peppy story of a B-29 bomber pilot and a nightclub singer he falls for after a brief meet-cute, to the point where he, when he goes off to war, Saipan, he names his plane in her honor without even knowing her name. You know, the boys are over there having some trouble, and they keep asking about the picture of the girl he's got up in the controls of the plane, and he's too embarrassed to tell him he doesn't even know her name, so they paint her picture on the side of the plane, call it the Blonde Bombshell, and then it becomes the terror of the Pacific Theater.
I actually really enjoyed that movie. I did see
that
movie.
Memphis Belle. Yeah, no, but then it stops being awesome, and they get called back to New York City to do a publicity tour.
Yeah.
And he runs into her, and because all the newsreels and everything are talking about the Blonde Bombshell and her pictures on the side of the plane, all these people flock to this nightclub to see her, and she's turned into this, you know,
and it becomes a musical.
Yeah, total celebrity, and he attempts a romance with her despite the machinations of his shrill socialite fiance. And
played by Jamie Gertz?
No. It's a very, very pretty movie. but man was clearly not an enthusiast of romantic movies or musicals. Yeah, so the entire thing's got this sort of detached, hired gun feel to it, really clean but mechanical.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and maybe it's me. I'm not into this sort of movie, and apparently neither was Anthony Mann. So it's not a complete bust, but it's not an enjoyable movie either.
Mm-hmm.
I remember liking it. It's one of those ones. I think
again, you're remembering Memphis Belle.
No, I had it in one of those collections.
Or House of Bamboo.
No, definitely not.
That's right. No, it was in one of those TCM things with the four movies.
Yeah, that was where I got it. Was from one of those collections, and I remember actually kind of enjoying it.
Once it goes back to New York City, it turns into the shiniest, most sparkly piece of crap you can imagine.
I actually kind of like the shininess and sparkliness of it.
It's like your kid ate an entire container of glitter glue and then pooped.
So you're saying that Brian Pope would like it?
Yes, definitely.
Oh, Pope would love it.
Pope would love it. Texas would dig it big time.
Eat it with a spoon.
And also that guy used to be in the jury room who was all about planes. the old dude in his 50s who lived in Hawaii and was a pilot.
He was like, this movie was amazing. No, they had the wrong landing gear on the model.
Yeah, that guy, he'd love it.
I agree that it's definitely a bad. It's not an ugly. It's definitely not an ugly. And,
oh, no.
And
it's,
everything about it.
It's nowhere near my ugly.
Yeah, and everything about it works, like, better than, say, Pearl Harbor, for example.
Yeah,
you know?
It's very schmaltzy, though.
Oh, it's schmaltzy, but it's that good, post-World War II.
Pearl Harbor wishes it had the level of marzipan this movie has.
I like schmaltzy when it's done, like, of its era, you know? Like, it's a movie that would never, ever fly today. See what I did there? But, you know, it...
Oh!
My thing is that it's... Each act of the movie could be its own movie.
Yeah.
And you kind of, you know, you got the opening bit with the doomed romance between, you know, the guy meets the girl of his dreams.
But he's
pretty much
off
the night before. The night before he ships out.
And that's the thing, is like with like 1946 movies, it's like, okay, we have to acknowledge the war, but our audiences want a bit of fun.
Yeah.
And you sort of get these kind of weird shots.
Yeah, so it's like each act could be its own movie, and I think it suffers because of that. And yeah, it's for that reason, Andrew, it's... I don't know how much of the movie was man. I don't know how much of the movie was the studio. I don't know how much of the movie was the screenwriter. And it's like they're all fighting for
something.
Fighting for attention until man was just like,
not going to fight anymore.
Yeah. I don't even care about musicals.
Well, it was one of those things, you know, that kind of came out.
Can we shoot somebody in a hand?
It came out of the whole post-World War II, you know, it Casablanca Fever and all of that stuff, you know, like everybody was just remaking Casablanca for what, about 12 years after Casablanca came out, you know, so it kind of falls into that.
The lead in this, I can't even remember his name, is not Humphrey Bogart.
No, it's not.
At all.
Yeah. All right. Gabe, bad. Go.
I chose another noir, T-Man, which I think was produced more or less around the same time that Roddy was, and I think it was originally released on DVD on the same disc. T-Man is it's a bad because it wants to be a kind of documentary thing where it starts and you have this guy that I don't know if he's an actor or he's actually the guy from the Treasury Bill, but he's saying that, oh, the story we are telling you today is about this and this, and these people are doing a very important job. And then the movie starts, and you have an annoying, like, smug narrator, like, telling you what's happening on the screen as it is happening. It takes you right out of the movie.
So it's like watching The Fifth Estate.
It's one of those. I mean, it comes from a time when I think there were a bunch of those movies. Like,
yeah, I think
the FBI would do one. It would be like, this is the story of federal agents and how they're great and keeping America safe. And so
involved, we've changed their names.
Yeah,
this is Johnny Goodboy. He is an FBI agent.
Yeah, exactly.
This is his office.
Like Dennis O'Keefe, who were sort of like completely lacking in charisma.
and the reason that I chose it for bad and not for ugly is again, John Alton. There is one, and one reason to see this movie, and it's for the photographic work that Alton does in this movie, which is mind-blowing.
I'm gonna slightly disagree with you there, but I'll let you finish talking about camera stuff. Go.
I mean, Rod Eel, as amazing as it looks, it still doesn't look quite as good as Team, and I really like everything that was done in this movie. With the atmosphere that they tried to create. And, I mean, the movie is kind of interesting. The story that they're trying to tell, it could be interesting, but every, like, 10 minutes or so, the narrator comes in and you get out, you know? Yeah. You're jumped back out of the movie again. There's some really great sequences. I'm thinking of, like, this guy's a, like he's an undercover agent and he's trying to find a man and he's going like across multiple saunas and like the way that is shot and edited is really, really well done. But I couldn't get really far into it because like the narrator would break my flow every time.
Now Gabriel Girard is telling us exactly why he doesn't like T-Man.
You have just heard from a French foreign national. there is one other reason to see this movie, and that is for one scene featuring the amazing Charles McGraw. I think you can see the scene on YouTube. There's this awesome, awesome scene in which one of the main characters is basically being muscled by two guys and having his fingers sort of threatened to be broken sort of one by one at the knuckle. And Charles McGraw is one of these gangsters, and he just plays this scene pitch perfect. It's amazing. Go to YouTube. Mm-hmm. I mean, find a reputable source for the film and pay for press. But other than that, I totally agree, yeah. It was really dry in comparison to Raw Deal, which felt so energetic.
Mm-hmm.
And it was lacking, like, Raw Deal, you know, had a lot of the cast had a fair amount of charisma going, and with the exception of Charles McGraw, who is a minor character in this movie, I kind of felt like everyone was just dry and bland.
Yeah.
And I didn't engage with it at all, for sure. All right, so I guess that leaves us with my bad, which is something we talked about a little bit before, The Fall of the Roman Empire. I should clarify, I love this movie.
It's awesome.
It's an awesome movie, but it's a long movie.
It's a really long
movie. And it's a really long movie, and it does definitely drag in places. But there are some really good things going for it. If you've seen Gladiator, a lot of elements of this movie will seem very familiar.
Yep.
Historical characters that appear in that movie appear in this movie. And for my money, some of them are played better here. I love Alec Guinness as Marcus Aurelius, but he's sort of a subdued presence in it. But for me, the two stars of this movie are James Mason as Timonides and Christopher Plummer as Commodus. Christopher Plummer plays Commodus.
You left out a part of Christopher Plummer's name. Christopher Plummer, great Canadian.
Great Canadian, yes. Christopher Plummer plays Commodus every bit as slimy and conniving as Joaquin Phoenix in Gladiator, but without, like, the obvious sort of, like,
psychological issues,
pedophile stuff going on. He is so good. After this movie, I wanted to be his boyfriend. he is just so badass in this movie. James Mason is this amazing presence throughout it. He has this tremendous voice of authority. He's used to great effect. This is definitely sort of straight arrow, authority figure James Mason, not creepy macking on a 14-year-old, going insane at the bottom of the ocean James Mason. But he's really, really good. Visually, there are few movies that can come close to Fall of the Roman Empire. There is a funeral during snowfall with Roman centurions and torches that is so gorgeous. I wish I could just have it playing on my wall as like background scenery. It is just tremendous looking. The sets, I mean, if the sets for El Cid were big, Fall of the Roman Empire, basically built Rome. It's unreal. And it's the kind of thing where I think they built Rome. It's like, hey, we could use wood. No, let's just use full-size marble columns. Commodus's throne room is this stunning, like, black and, if I'm remembering right, it's like black and gold with some, like, serpentine imagery or something. Like, it just looks super cool. It's, you know, again, depending on your tolerance for Sophia Loren, I quite liked her in it. I thought she was pretty good.
She still looks a little bit like an alien.
A little bit, yeah. But, you know, that's her thing.
Yeah.
Stephen Boyd, I think he's a good actor, but he's kind of a stick. You know, like, he's not super charismatic. He's not charismatic when you put him up against powerhouses like Alec Guinness and James Mason and Christopher Plummer. That's when, you know, Omar Sharif is in this, Mel Ferrer is in this, John Ireland is in this. So to play against that as the lead, it's tough for a guy like Stephen Boyd. And he's sort of the center of the movie. Another slight drawback, you know, we talked about these amazing battle scenes and crowd scenes. Most of those in The Fall of the Roman Empire are also terrific.
Yeah.
But there is one barbarian fight where it's kind of obvious. You've just got these guys in, like, orange wigs kind of waving swords in the air. And, you know, by today's standards, it doesn't pack the same punch. But for the most part, this is, like, the super production to end all super productions. And, you know, even with all its faults, it is so worth watching. I love it. Yeah.
Worth adding. Just thought I'd throw this out there so you know. It's also available on Amazon.ca on Blu-ray for $10.94.
What? When did this happen?
I don't know. I think it's an import. I think it's a Region 2 import, actually.
Oh, because if it's an import, it might be this really ugly, smeary-looking import.
Anchor Bay. It's released by Anchor Bay.
Oh, okay. Well, I'll check it out, because I didn't know that, and now...
Also there, El Cid and Quo Vadis.
I knew Quo Vadis was out. But I didn't know that Fall of the Roman Empire and El Cid were out. Go to your local retailer.
Go to DVDVerdict.com and then hit up the Amazon links.
Hit up the Amazon links through DVD Verdict, and pennies will fall into a magic bucket. And if enough pennies fall into that magic bucket, we'll have the rapture and we'll all be happy. All right, that's the bad. Let's talk about the ugly.
I have an ugly.
Mine, actually.
I do have. I'm just saying.
Okay. Yeah, I'm jumping the queue here. My ugly is 1946, same year as Bamboo Blonde, but not as good from what I hear. I have not seen Bamboo Blonde, but I have seen Strange Impersonation. And this is a really, really flawed movie. It's basically this sort of nonsensical plot about a scientist conducting experiments and then is blackmailed by a woman she accidentally knocked down, and also the scientist's assistant is, like, jealous of her relationship and sabotages an experiment to explode chemicals in her face like the Joker and Batman. And then she's all disfigured and gets plastic surgery and takes on another identity. It is every bit as convoluted as it sounds. It is not half as interesting as it sounds. It looks flat. Compounding it is one of the worst twist endings. It's super trite and insulting, especially for sort of the gender politics of today. The movie is interesting in that it features a female scientist, and this is 1946. You know, so most of the time when you would have, you know, a scientist type character or a figure of authority, it would be a male character. That all sounds great. The problem is, and I'm going to spoil this a bit, is the motive, the sort of moral of the movie is really women should probably become wives and go home. Because, you know, I mean, it's all good to play around with your chemistry sets, but you're not men, are you?
Okay, that automatically jumps it right into my good.
This is the kind of stuff that happens. Okay.
Damn women folk back in their place.
This is a movie, you know, there's this whole, you know, disaster, it comes down, police show up, blah, 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 airport. Oh, was it all a dream? Is she actually going to marry her sweetheart and become a good little housewife? Maybe.
Tune in next year for Strange Impersonation 2.
And then she gets shot right at the end.
Yeah.
Will she marry her sweetheart and become a...
She gets hit by a taxiing bomb.
And Walter Houston bursts out of her chest. Yeah, it's really bad. You know, there are a few flourishes. You know, Ant-Man kind of does, I think, what he can with the material, but you can also tell he's really not invested. He knows it's a shitty story. And it just doesn't have the same kind of visual punch that his better movies have, certainly.
Well, I will freely admit that your plot synopsis sounded terrible.
Yeah.
The moral of the story is get back in the kitchen.
Basically, yeah. Now, Steve, if you're done making me a sandwich, perhaps you would like to talk about Your Ugly.
Yeah, I will, actually. And it's a film I kind of didn't even realize was an Anthony Mann movie. And I'd seen it a few times. You know, one of those movies that, like, when I was growing up, it was one of Dad's regular choices, right? One of those westerns that Dad always fired up. That is, where is the year it came out? I can't even remember. 1960, Cimarron.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure a lot of people like Cimarron. I'm sure you guys will probably go on and think I'm crazy and all of that kind of stuff. But compared to the rest of his body of work, especially his westerns, like what he did with Stewart, it does not feel like an Anthony Mann movie.
This is a big studio.
Yeah, this is a big, by the numbers, you know, as stereotypical and plain as just tap water, you know, community approved, committee sanctioned.
Fun for the whole family.
Yeah, all out, you know, event western movie is what it is, you know, and it feels entirely rote. From the first strains, you know, that nice little saccharine score, and it, you know, that over the top happy western music right to the final credits. You know, it never really goes anywhere. It's just, I mean, there's elements in there that I could see, you know, like little things, little character quirks and stuff that might make it an Anthony Mann movie. Like our main character, Cimarron, is a little cold, I guess, or detached is the word. But even then, it doesn't have that same degree of character that you see in his other movies. Like, it does feel more like, you know, more like one of the John Ford crowd pleasers, or, you know, like, not to...
Like, what was the Cinerama one? How the West Was Won?
Yeah, yes, yeah, exactly, you know?
Yeah.
You know, paint.
And this was, I mean, wasn't Cimarron one of the early Best Picture winners? And it's, like, sort of like one of those, like, oh, classic American novels of pioneers. So I have a feeling at the time it was probably, like, well, they're remaking Cimarron!
Yeah, yeah. It's going to be a gigantic, colossal event. It's going to be 150 minutes long, and it's going to suck.
In Snorovision.
But yeah, it is. It really is one of those, you know, big event movies. And, you know, you can kind of see the hints of Mann's, like, what was going to follow with El Cid and with Fall of the Roman Empire. Like, it's got, I guess I'd call it the bridge film between, like, his historical epics and his westerns. but it just it doesn't have
and
that.
Definitely, I mean, his previous Western, Man of the West, is like has a lot of the stuff he would throw into his sort of earlier, grittier stuff. So
it just, I mean, until you know, I looked through him tonight and saw like, whoa, crap, Cimarron in the Man movie. It's that one thing where you look at it and you kind of say, No. It just doesn't feel like his work.
And as a fan of Glenn Ford, it's extra sad.
Yeah, and it's just, it's kind of boring.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of a lifeless movie, you know?
I mean, everything I'm saying about it is based on sort of reputation and things I've heard other people say.
Okay.
I have heard that the Land Rush sequence is pretty cool.
Oh, well,
just from, like, an action filmmaking.
It's a bunch of people running on a horse, you know?
Yeah.
It's good.
May as well watch Far and Away or whatever it is.
Exactly. You know, Ron Howard basically reshot it in 1991 or 1990, whatever it was, you know?
Well, but, that movie is not really good either.
So. You shut your mouth.
This is the first thing we have to say. Check every time we go to a movie. Is there a Land Rush? Yes. Pass.
But yeah, it's, you know, I don't, I, it just, it feels so heartless. It just, it feels like an empty exercise.
Mm-hmm.
And when so much of Man stuff, I mean, and I love a lot of Man stuff. I mean, just going back in. You guys still there? Did I lose anybody?
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah.
Everything just went quiet for some reason. Anyway, but going back and looking through his body of work, like, he's one of those guys who I look down through the list of what he's done and I see, you know, stuff that I love that I didn't really equate with him. Like, you know, I mean, I equate him to El Cid, Fall of the Roman Empire, Raw Deal. You know, like, I equate him to those movies and to an extent, I guess, Winchester 73. But, you know, like, I see so many westerns and stuff like that I really enjoyed, The Far Country or The Man from Laramie, you know, like, and all movies that I really liked and just didn't realize were Anthony Mann movies. And then
but they felt personal still.
Yeah. And like when I think about them, I think, you know what? Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Definitely. I can totally see the connective tissue there, you know, like I can definitely see like, why didn't I realize that was an Anthony Mann movie? I just never bothered to check, I guess, you know, like that kind of thing. But, when I see Cimarron, I'm like, huh? Really? You know? It's kind of like, he really did that?
It may as well be like Richard Fleischer's stab at a Western.
Yeah, exactly.
And I like, you know, we talked about Richard Fleischer. I like him, but he's not a personal filmmaker.
No. And apparently he didn't get to finish Cimarron. Apparently he was fired from Cimarron before it was completed. So maybe that's part of it too. Maybe the studio just cut the movie together and such. So
it's probably because he was like, all right, we're going to have this scene where Glenn Ford is going to take Ann Baxter by the face and dig his thumbs into her eyes. And we're like, probably not.
Yeah. And in the end, his mother's going to show up and shoot him.
Yeah.
Yeah, there you go. Cimarron.
All right, John, ugly.
My ugly is 1955 Strategic Air Command.
You would go after another bomber movie that I love, wouldn't you bastard?
Again, you're mixing this up. I'm buying you Memphis Belle for your birthday.
I have Memphis Belle.
As we can hear from Steve, there are certainly fans of old war films or Jimmy Stewart or old Tommy pictures out there who will disagree with me about Strategic Air Command.
Are you calling Jimmy Stewart racist?
Strategic Air Command, or as I like to call it, SAC, as in sweaty.
Dude, those aerial sequences were amazing.
Or as you call it, SAC, as in Strategic Air SAC.
If these people can hate Top Gun for being a Navy recruitment commercial disguised as a rock and roll music video in 1986. I can hate Strategic Air Command for being an Air Force recruitment video disguised as a rah-rah USA stage show in 1955. So just get this. I got to leave this out. James Stewart is an aging baseball star who just had a stellar season, just signed a hot contract, and just got recalled to active duty for 21 months in Strategic Air Command in case those dirty commie savages decide to unleash nuclear Armageddon.
Is this when 70-year-olds were still playing in the majors?
Yeah.
What follows is a tedious drama with no stakes.
Hey!
All for the purpose of showing off the latest, in 1955, toys that our boys in the Jets had courtesy of the full cooperation of the USAF. Now, I wouldn't have a problem with that if it was an adventure, or a tense thriller, or a military procedural, or a movie, or something, anything, outside of an old shoulder injury from his years on the diamond, returning to haunt poor old Jimmy, or his clingy shrew of a wife.
Hey, I thought that was super intense when I was like 8, when he's trying to land the plane and his arm seizes up.
Yeah.
That was exciting, goddammit.
You were 8.
I was 8. I used to own that movie on beta.
Caravans was thrilling.
Yeah. I like Jimmy Stewart. Air Command on beta, okay.
I like Jimmy Stewart. I respect Jimmy Stewart, and he did some great, great films with man. This isn't one of them.
Harry Morgan plays Sergeant Bible. And cut. Actually, can you make that sound more like a wet fart?
Oh my god. Why would you do that?
One away from your ass. That wasn't me.
Somebody call Strategic Air Command.
Oh, this is totally devolving.
Okay.
Yeah, I just love the hamminess of it all. You know, he's a baseball star despite being old. You know, he just had the greatest season of his career. But we're not going to mention that Hank Aaron was a better player. And, you know, he's just signed his great big contract, and now he's got to go sit on an air base somewhere.
Mm.
And nothing's going to happen for the rest of the movie. He'll nearly crash a plane. It's like the Blue Max. Do you guys remember the Blue Max?
The Blue Max was awesome. Are you going to diss the Blue Max now?
You're a fucking idiot.
What is it about you and old time
movie was movies? About a Russian rogue.
No, the Blue Max wasn't even that old, man. The Blue Max, like, George Peppard looked like he was in his 60s in that movie.
But it was an awesome movie.
Which was probably because of the whiskey.
Peppard! Fresh ground Peppard?
I love the Blue Max.
See, I was saying all this stuff to make Forbes mad at me, and I'm making you mad at me.
Yeah, what the hell is going on here?
I don't give a shit. I've never seen shit. It sounds like something I would hate.
Or that, or again, that old guy from the jury room.
I hope he doesn't listen to this show.
Because he's going to fucking hate this one, because Strategic Air Command, now that is some goddamn accurate shit. Probably because the entire movie was filmed by the recruitment office, but...
All jacket collars approved by the United States Air Force. Properly starched.
Sorry. Are we done?
Just hope America stays free.
Well, I'll jump in and say that I didn't get to be big enough into Anthony Mann to pick an ugly. So,
God, you're pulling a McVeigh.
No, I'm not pulling a McVeigh. I'm saying I have not seen enough of his movies that I haven't seen an ugly. Like, I selected good movies, I guess, and was lucky. I mean, how many movies this guy made? You know,
I've got an eject key on my keyboard, but it's not having any effect on Gabe.
I mean, it's like, you know, if you're throwing darts at the map with all of his movies mapped out, how long will it take before you hit an ugly, you know?
Depends on where it lands. Guess.
Just shut up, Andrew.
This hypothetical situation is full of holes.
This is almost as full of holes as the Furies. I mean, strategic.
Hey, man, the Furies actually isn't that full of holes.
No.
But this situation is as terrible as the Blue Mix.
But, I'm sure that I could find an ugly for Mane if I watch more of his movies, is what I'm saying. But I think I'll get into my thoughts of why maybe I didn't see that many of his movies, and I'll get back to what I was saying, that I was having a kind of a hard time a bit to, like, relate to his movies, to get drawn in by them. You know, like, if we compare him to John Ford, like, for Ford, I'm really interested in looking at more of his work, and, like, because his movies spoke to me, but man, not so much. Like,
I have pantomime.
I don't
bar fights with Irish guys singing.
It goes back to what I was saying before. Because he's a transitional figure, and because he was trying all these different things, like, because he was trying to kind of change the game, but at the same time he was playing the studio game, so his movies feel a bit schizophrenic.
He also makes almost no effort to make any of his characters, at least the characters in his really good movies, remotely likable.
Yeah.
It's true. It is true.
And even, I mean, I can deal with unlikable characters, but, like, often I find not the performances, because the performances are really good, but more like the characterization keeps you at the distance too from them. Because, like, if you get an unlikable guy, that's your protagonist, but he's, like...
Well, he often has... I mean, he often makes it so you're not quite sure...
Yeah, exactly.
...what these guys are, like, deliberately. But that, I mean, that definitely would... it has an effect of kind of, like, you don't get a quick grasp of who these guys are, and you can't... I mean, you know, for certain film noirs, it's like, okay, this guy's a bastard. Watch it on those terms. But especially a lot of the Jimmy Stewart westerns, like, and you're not really sure how nice of a guy he is.
He's pretty enigmatic, yeah.
Yeah.
And I think maybe that's a bit of my problem, because I think if it was the same kind of scenario, but he was making straight-up noirs, I would be more into it. But yeah, since he's doing it in a Western, it kind of makes me uncomfortable, I guess.
Almost moral uncertainty in mountain shots is just...
But there are way too many horses in this movie. Not sure how I feel about horses.
But
I can't get a read on that horse.
But
at first I thought he was an evil horse, but now I'm not so sure.
But it's weird because I'm a huge Sergio Leone fan, and you can definitely see the influence of Mann on Sergio Leone, but, like, Leone is, like, the epitome of what Mann was trying to do, kind of, you know? Why Mann was, like, working his way up there, you know?
You can definitely see Mann's influence on Leone and Peckinpah in particular.
Yeah.
Their westerns, you know, these guys, it's like everything else, you know, like Quentin Tarantino comes along and everybody thinks he's this big genius innovator and da-da-da-da-da, and he comes like, no, guys, I learned all of my stuff from these, you know, all these other filmmakers in the 60s and 70s, and, you know, and then, like, I learned it from Leone or from Peckinpah or whoever, and then you go back to Leone and Peckinpah and you think, oh, wow, these guys really changed how it was done. I mean, Peckinpah, you know, in film circles pretty much birthed the term postmodern Western, you know? And yet you had Anthony Mann doing it, what, 20 years before Peckinpah?
Yeah,
you know?
And that's the thing. I think it's because, like, Leone and Peckinpah were giving more room, you know? They were giving more freedom than Mann had. And Mann was, like, too early to try to do this stuff, and his impulses were, like, stifled. And maybe this is why...
Peckinpah never had problems with studio interference. I know what you're saying, though. The culture had changed at that point.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, of course, those guys still had their problems, but still, I mean, you could never see the Wild Bunch in the 50s. You know?
Oh, my God, no. Absolutely not.
I don't know. Yeah, I found maybe it's the whole transitional thing, you know, because he's coming in between John Ford and those guys.
He was absolutely straddling eras too. I mean, he was there for the rise of the independent producers and sort of the beginning of the end for.
It's always harder to get into these guys that are like pushing the boundaries, but they're exploring the country, but they haven't really settled. You know,
it's often easier to respect them than to love them.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And so that's my feelings on Anthony Mann.
Well, I think the guy was a brilliant stylist, and I mean, like, he didn't have the same flash that later guys did. Like, I mean, even contemporaries like David Lean, of course, but now you're looking at comparing Anthony Mann to David Lean is like comparing Anton Fuqua to Steven Spielberg, only without the lack of talent. I don't mean that in a technical sense. I mean, like, in terms of, you know, influence and resources available to him, you know? Like, Mann was essentially a hired gun and a child of the studio system, not...
But when I go back, like, I came into Leone way before Anthony Mann.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? As I think a lot of people just naturally would.
Yes, mm-hmm. Sure.
But, you know, when I dug back in and I started to see how Mann was playing with the frame and how he was using violence in Westerns and stuff, I think he had a big influence
huge.
On Sergio Leone.
Huge, of course.
And even, like, well, I mean, Leone himself will tell you, you know, John Ford, Akira Kurosawa, you know, like, well, he would tell you if he were still alive. But
and he'd say it in Italian because he couldn't speak English.
Exactly.
Some kind of dirty anecdote at the same time.
But either way, you know, like, man, he was a guy whose style was distinct, especially for the era that he worked in. Technically, really, really polished. I mean, his stuff was edited brilliantly.
The gunfight at the end of Winchester 73.
Oh, it was amazing.
Oh, yeah.
Shang off the boulders and stuff.
Yeah.
Just terrific.
And I loved The Far Country. I thought that movie was absolutely fantastic. Like, as far as Westerns go, that's one that I really kind of enjoy. And, of course, well, Fall of the Roman Empire and El Cid were the blueprint for, you know, the modern rebirth of the historical epic. I mean, they were made at a time when the epics were kind of dying. And, Fall of the Roman Empire bankrupted its producer, so, you know.
And I feel like this is the kind of thing that Ridley Scott is digging back to almost more than David Lean.
I agree totally. And you can see that in it. Like, you sit down, you watch Fall of the Roman Empire, and it doesn't feel like Gladiator. Gladiator is a much more modern, it's a much more...
it's more of an action movie.
Yes, yeah, it's much more chaotic.
It's designed as an action movie.
It's designed to be a rousing spectacle, whereas The Fall of the Roman Empire is almost designed to be, you know, like a historical treatise. And you can see the influence there for sure. You know, you can see, and I mean, Scott's another director. He's one of those directors who loves his contrast. He loves his light and his dark. You know, he loves that painterly look. And Mann is definitely one of the earliest, you know, one of the earliest purveyors.
I have to work on that,
you know,
on that scale.
Yeah,
and
like to present, you know, that whole. I mean, everybody talks about Citizen Kane and a few other movies of that era, you know, that were like gorgeous visual films that changed, like, you know, the language of film and stuff. Yes, and entirely accurate statements, all. However, what I get from Mann is he's one of the few directors out of the 50s who was shooting films in a modern style. I don't mean modern for 60s or 70s. I mean modern for 21st century. Like, a lot of the techniques and a lot of the stylistic touches that he brought, a lot of his flourishes are still very much in use today. And a lot of the other guys, like even guys like John Ford and stuff like that. I mean, you know, you see John Ford in some of the earlier Richard Donner stuff, and I don't mean like thematic and stuff. I mean more like tech from a technical standpoint.
Yeah,
you know, these straight ahead action filmmakers that came in the 80s and late 70s. These guys were like, you know, the John Fords and whatnot. But with Mann, you know, you really get these visualists. You get guys like Ridley Scott. You get what's his name? The guy who did Killing Me Softly and Assassination of Jesse James. God.
Oh, yeah.
Andrew Dominic?
Yes, Andrew Dominic. Like, you see a little bit of his work. Of course, well, another one. Thin Red Line.
Malick.
Yeah, Terrence Malick. Like, you even see, like, hints of it in Malick. Now, Malick is a lot more... Malick loves his slow-mo and he loves to linger, you know, but... You do see, like, those, that same, that painterly.
But you get some of those sort of, like, elemental kind of elements. Like this sort of, this attempt to convey that elemental power, in the landscapes and sort of rumbling clouds and
just that use of light and dark and stuff. You know, the way he lights a scene, the way he uses natural light. He, like, from a technical standpoint, he was very much a director ahead of his time, and I mean a lot of his work is. You know, he's got such a wide breadth. You know, like he's got like from the westerns to the noir to these big historical epics, and like. It's hard to pin him down to any one genre. Like, you could say he's a Western guy, but he's not really, you know? Like, you could say he's a film noir guy because he really made his name there, but he's not really. Or you could say he's a historical epic guy, but he only did two of them. That'd be like saying Ridley Scott was a science fiction guy. You know? Like, he's just all around. He's versatile and really, really skilled. You know? Like, he's one of those guys that, you know, for mainstream moviegoers, I wouldn't say, you know, he's not like John Ford, where it's if you want to understand film, you've got to go back and watch John Ford. But for people who are interested in the technical side of filmmaking, for people who are interested in visuals and you know, scene composition.
And the evolution of tone.
Yeah. He is a must. He is definitely a study. You know, he is definitely someone you got to sit down and you got to observe, right?
Yeah. I agree with everything you said.
I'm not really going to add anything to that because I'll sound like an idiot. One final point, though, on Anthony Mann for me. I really think it would have been truly interesting to see what he could have done once the 70s rolled around.
Yeah, like, once
that movie maker started to change, right?
Yeah. When
he went away. Yeah. But that's what steak and egg breakfast every day and cigarettes will do for you, probably.
He was a man's man.
Yep. Oh, a man's man.
Oh, I didn't even realize I did that. Oh. Thanks, Andrew.
No, you did that on purpose. Don't. I take no responsibility for that. All right, so I think that is Anthony Mann. Do we know who we are dealing with next time, gentlemen?
Oh, do we ever.
Oh, God.
Next episode, no, I'm excited, guys, because guess what?
What?
I'm picking a respectable director this week.
Oh!
What?
So, next episode, we've got a real Fire and Thunder epic in store. There's going to be naval warfare, Amish intrigue, sexual tension, reality TV, and monomaniacal escapes from 80s greed into the jungles of the Caribbean. Eat your bacon, drink your beers, say your prayers, and join us as we dive into the films and career of Australian auteur Peter Weir.
Woo!
See you next Wednesday.